Good day. You're listening to European Buddha.
As weather is changing and autumn invites us to let go, we continue our journey with our Basic Truth series. Today's topic is about what some people sometimes regard as a universal bank account, karma. For this, we invited a special guest. Her name is Monisha, also known as Kathleen Hopper. She is a member of the Triratna Buddhist Order and works as Triratna Safeguarding Officer, advising centers in the UK and Europe on keeping adults and children safe from harm in Buddhist activities. She's British and lives in Sweden, helping to run the Stockholm Buddhist Center. So, hello, Monisha, and hello, Amelia. It's very nice to see you. And please, Monisha, would you set the tone for today's episode by leading some kind of a practice?
Hello. Yes, I'd be happy to do that. So if you'd like to just start by sitting back in your chair, ideally it would be a nice upright chair for all the people who are listening to us. And just make sure your back is well supported, the base of your back is well supported by the back of the chair. And I'd invite you to close your eyes. If you feel comfortable to do that, it's a bit less distracting. And just to start by taking a few quiet, deep breaths, breathing out and letting go. And having a sense of your bottom on the seat, the contact with the seat. And your feet flat on the floor. Really having a sense of the contact between your feet and the floor. So you're grounded. And breathing out deeply again. Letting go of whatever else you've just been doing. From a Buddhist point of view, it's also important that the intention that we have as we sit and use the breathing to relax and become more aware. We can have an intention, for example, to breathe in with kindness towards ourselves and to breathe out with kindness towards others. From a Buddhist point of view, everything that we do and say and think has an effect. It has an effect on us and it has an effect on others. So it's really important that we take time to be conscious of a positive intention, to wish ourselves well and to wish others well. So breathing in with kindness for yourself. Kindness, patience, forgiveness. And breathing out with kind, patience, forgiveness for others too. And now noticing how you're feeling now. Maybe being a bit curious whether you feel the same now as you did at the beginning. Different or just the same. And you're ready, opening your eyes and moving about a bit and bringing this short meditation to a close.
Thank you, Monisha, and also hi to Martin. That was such a nice calming down and clearing the mind this morning. I hope our listeners also enjoyed this starting off the day. So let's go straight to the point. Karma is one of the most used terms in Buddhism. How would you define it as from a Buddhist perspective?
Yeah, good question. I mean, karma is such a common term now, probably since the 1960s in Western languages. It's kind of slipped rather in its meaning. It literally means action. In Sanskrit, one of the ancient languages of the Buddhist time, it literally means action, and that's all it means, literally. So there are various teachings of karma. There are Hindu teachings of karma, and there's a Buddhist teaching of karma. So the Buddhist teaching of karma is that actions have consequences. Everything we do and think and say has an effect on us and on others. And that is very short summary of the meaning of this word. But I can unpack it a bit more.
Yeah, they say there's like kind of good karma and bad karma. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, so it's not random. Actions have consequences, and there is what is often said in English to be a law of karma, Buddhist law of karma. That doesn't mean like, you know, the law from the government. It means like a principle or a rule of how it works. It's logical. So the Buddha taught that positive actions have positive consequences and negative actions have negative consequences. However, we can't leave it there because what people think are positive and negative is very subjective. So the Buddha was very clear. He said actions of body and speech and mind that are motivated by kindness, generosity, courage, patience, and a desire for welfare of others, self and others, have enjoyable consequences. And actions, things that you do and you think and you say, which are motivated by hate, unkindness, impatience, selfishness, cruelty, they will have very unpleasant consequences for us. We will not enjoy them. And others will not enjoy them either. People sometimes think it's a bit random, you know, like, hey, you know, I shut my hand in the car door. That's because I trod on a spider last week.
Mm. You know, that's true.
There is no obvious link between those two things. And although the scriptures are a little bit unclear, the Buddha appears to contradict himself a bit in the scriptures. He was his general point was that there is usually an obvious connection, a logical connection between action and consequences, although no one has ever managed to define what it is. And so he said, you know, you don't have to believe this just because I say so. Observe it in your own experience. So that's what I would say to anyone listening to this. You don't have to believe anything I'm saying, but look and see in your own experience whether actions have consequences and what kind of consequences they have.
And there are so many actions during the day, during last year, during, you could say, also lifetimes. Mm. So often we encounter this idea of karma also with many lifetimes. And it's not only about the future, it is also about the past. Sometimes it is stated, we are the result of our past actions.
Oh, that's, yes. Well, I mean, this brings in the whole other completely different topic of rebirth, which is a very traditional Buddhist teaching. We can't get away from that. It is traditional. The Buddha himself said he had seen that he had lived through many lifetimes and he had seen actions and consequences unfolding through those lifetimes and forming the person he was. And I think that you can definitely see in this lifetime, or I can see, that what I have done and thought and said through this life has formed the person I become in each moment or in each day. So I would invite people to not to speculate too much about whether we're the result of previous karma and previous lifetimes, because we really don't know. But I can certainly see that things that I did last year, for example, have made me a different person now. And how I was as a child has contributed to the kind of person I am as an adult. So I think this whole thing about rebirth is a bit speculative, but it seems completely logical to me. I mean, even if you just do therapy, you know, if you make an effort to do therapy, you will become a different kind of person. Yeah, in this lifetime. So you can see that, you can prove it.
So past actions contribute to what we become, but they don't determine.
No, that's true. This is another big topic. The karma is only one kind of what we call conditionality in Buddhism. There are a number of different kinds of things that happen, or different kinds of, you could say, forces, I suppose, in life that form who we become. And not all of them are within our control. And some of them are just things that we've inherited. Arguably, they could be things from previous lifetimes. We just came into them in this lifetime. We came into this life with these things. They're not within our control, but they tend to form the way we are. You know, the way that our parents were brought up could have an effect on the kind of person we became in childhood. But that's just inherited. We can't actually have any control over that. But the Buddha did say, whatever you come into this life with, you have a choice. So two people in this life who've had exactly the same kind of conditioning could have very different responses to that conditioning. And those choices we make, we always have a choice. It's really important to remember in Buddhism that we always have a choice. The difficulty is having enough awareness to notice that we have the choice. And this is why we meditate. Somebody could speak really unkindly to me, and I could just automatically hit them on the nose. If I have no self-awareness and no kind of anger management skills, okay, I'll probably still feel angry, but I might choose to take a moment and breathe in and breathe out and think, this person is really annoying me, but I'm not going to hit them because the consequences will not be good. So there is a moment, there is a gap, very, very important principle in Buddhism. There is a gap between something happening and our response to it. And our responsibility is to develop a deeper and deeper awareness of that gap so that we can make better and better choices, which will have better and better, more positive effects in our lives so that we and others become happier. That's a long answer to your question.
Very good.
Yeah, and it's a lot of work. We have to remind ourselves every day, kind of all the time, because sometimes things spill out. But then we also have the choice. Okay, now I come back. I apologize. Let's start again. And it's really the good news here. Yeah. But it's a lot of work.
It is. But it's really worth it because we experience the consequences.
Exactly.
When you take the trouble to notice that you have actually been unkind, and you take the trouble to apologize and make amends, you can repair relationships and you will feel much better and your friends will feel much better. You'll be a much more pleasant person to know because you have the awareness and then you follow through on it, knowing that actions have consequences.
To my mind comes this story. I was eavesdropping the other day and I heard a lady talk about her fighting with the boyfriend, and she had this new idea that always when there comes a little fight, she starts hugging her boyfriend, and little by little they started cooling down, and this is what they now do. And sometimes it seems that it's good to eavesdrop, because I think I'm starting to practice this as well.
Yeah, great. I often think actually this is one of the things we can look at in the way we are with other people. Is my behavior right now bringing me closer to people or pushing me further away from them? It would be important, I think, in that kind of setting, not to pretend you weren't angry. And just cover it up with a hug. One of the common misconceptions about Buddhism is that it's all about being nice. And actually, we do have to acknowledge when we feel angry. The difference is that, and I might even say, I'm feeling really angry. Can we talk about it? Which is, but not to hit the person. Or throw china, throw the plates. Important to be honest.
And also this feeling of anger makes us act. If you think of the climate change, and there's so much things going wrong in the world today, so this can be good energy to use to make things better.
Yeah, definitely. And anger is one of the three root poisons that the Buddha said really at the heart of our suffering: greed, hatred or anger, and delusion or ignorance about the way life really is. Those three things, the Buddha said, are just at the heart of unenlightened human beings. And so even if we know that acting kindly and generously will bring us happiness and acting selfishly will bring us unhappiness. You know, we carry on behaving in unhelpful ways because there is this these three things just rooted in human beings. And he didn't attempt to explain why that is. He just said, if you look in your own experience, you will see those three things are there. So you need to develop more and more awareness so that you don't act on them.
This leads to a good question about safety. If there's a lot of anger, you work as a safety inspector. How do you call it?
My job in the Triratna Buddhist community, which I'm part of, Triratna Buddhist community, is to be safeguarding officer. So I have a job where I am advising all our centres, so our local centres in cities around Europe and mostly Europe, how to keep all their adults and children safe from harm in the course of Buddhist activities. In Britain, this is a very important part of running any charity or a non-profit association, you could say, including faith organisations. They all have a public duty to ensure that people are not harmed physically, sexually, not discriminated against on the grounds of sexuality or race or gender, disability. We've appointed a safeguarding officer to each of our centres. And if anybody feels that they are being harmed, or perhaps they feel that people teaching classes are not behaving very ethically with the people coming to the classes, they can just talk directly to the safeguarding officer. So you don't have any gossip, people complaining on Facebook, which is not effective. You take your complaint straight to the safeguarding officer, who says, we'll listen to you and then act on, make sure that something is done about this and look into it. And if it's criminal, they will report it to the police. And that is an absolute duty. So that is what safeguarding is. It's a British-English term. It just means protection. So I'm the central safeguarding officer and I give out advice to all the people in the different centres. And I train them and I write policies for them. And those policies should be on their websites. And then that also increases people's confidence that this is a Buddhist tradition in which they can feel safe. And if something goes wrong, they know exactly what to do. They don't have to worry about looking stupid if they raise a complaint.
Everyone does not have a safeguard. If one feels unsafe or witnesses someone being unsafe, what should one do?
Well, most British Buddhist organisations would have a safeguarding officer. But in other organisations, in other countries, I would say that you would probably ask to speak to what somebody on the council of the centre, like the board of trustees or the governing body, whoever it is in that organisation that has the legal responsibility for running that organisation, I would ask to go and talk to one of them in confidence. But be very aware that if you tell them something that is potentially criminal, they will need to report it to the police. So you can't expect them to be completely confidential. But it isn't easy, because in many organisations, there isn't anybody who is responsible. And I think that's something that Buddhist organizations really need to look at.
This position you hold as a safeguarding officer is very interesting, because it's like Buddhism entering society and entering, maybe you could also say, Western society. Maybe before that it was more or less a monastic context, but now it's getting into the world and things are getting even more complex. So what is your experience from this transition of Buddhism coming to the West and being applied and facing new challenges?
Well, it is interesting, because in the Buddha's time, you know, what he called the Sangha would probably have just been small groups of mostly men, but also women who committed themselves to following his path, to being homeless wanderers, what we would now call monks. And they didn't belong to any organizations. They're probably just, you know, five or six in little groups of people living in the forest. They didn't have any homes. They didn't have any money. They didn't have to run a Buddhist center. You know, then as Buddhism became more established, they started to live together in monastic communities which then have to have people, they have to have money and people running them. And as Buddhism in the modern world, well, there are some Buddhist groups that literally only meet in people's own living rooms. They just all teach each other, you know, and then, but if you want to run a Buddhist center, if you want to hold property and money and start to own things in common, then you have to set up legal bodies to run them. And that's when you start to get the potential for things going, well, very well, but also going very wrong, because groups, things happen in groups, in organized groups, that don't necessarily happen in very small, just groups of friends. And that's when you get institutional responsibilities. So we do have these new challenges. And we also have new awareness of the harm caused by sexual abuse of adults and of children, which has always happened. But we didn't, until we started setting up institutions, we didn't have institutional responsibility for addressing it. Certainly today, if you want to run a Buddhist center, you can't just ignore complaints that the teachers are sexually abusing the students. That's an abuse of their position of trust, I would say, which is a fairly modern legal concept, that a person who has authority also has responsibility, and they are trusted and they should behave in a particular way that is deserving of the trust put in them.
And what is your vision in this regard, or your motivation, intention for the future? What can be done?
Well,
it.
I mean, I train everybody in my organization to, you know, to all the Buddhist centers in my organization, that they should have a named person, they should have policies, they should have training. And I really hope that something of that system will also be developed in all Buddhist organizations. Some people feel that it feels a bit like Big Brother. You know, they sort of complain, particularly people who came to Buddhism in the 1960s, who saw Buddhism as a kind of anti-establishment. Sometimes those people criticize it and say, oh, this is the state interfering in our slightly anarchistic free Buddhist movement, to which I have to say, well, unfortunately, things seem to have gone wrong in the in the past, so we do need this. and we should do this as an expression of precepts to avoid harming living beings. And this is a practical way to avoid harming living beings. And they say, oh, but we've got the precepts, we've got our ethical teachings, we don't need any of this stuff with safeguarding policies. And then I always say, okay, so when do you have a fire alarm in your Buddhist center? Do you have instructions for what to do when it rings? So imagine you didn't have any instructions for what to do when it rings. What would you do with the precepts when the fire alarm rings? How useful are the precepts when you're in a difficult situation? But they're not useful at all, because they're not practical. They're principles. So safeguarding policies and principles are a practical application of the ethical precepts.
Yeah, as I listened to you, Manisha, I really had the feeling that all your work you are doing is basically a service to the Buddha Dharma, a question of creating the right settings so the teachings can be heard. It's one of the most important things we can do if we want to contribute something in general. So thank you for your work, and thank you, Emilia, for this today's episode. The last words are often for our guests, or Emilia, if you are inspired to say something.
Yes, I like telling little poems. Martin started with talking about letting go autumn season. And we also cleared our mind with Manisha's practice in the beginning. So I think this little poem from Wu Men goes well here. 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind isn't clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. Thank you so much, and have a beautiful day with good intentions.